When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 146. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading down to Rutland to talk to farmer Jan McCraw. Jan, how are you?
I'm very well, Will. Thank you for this.
Good. I've said you're in Rutland now, but are you in Rutland, or is it actually Leicestershire?
I straddle the border.
Do you? Okay.
Yes. So I'm speaking to you from the farmhouse, which is actually in Leicestershire.
Right.
But just down the hill across the brook is Rutland, and the farm spans the brook, which separates the two.
Right, okay. So for overseas listeners who might not know, Rutland is the smallest county in the UK. It's a lovely part of the country, isn't it? Would it be fair to describe it as quintessentially rural England?
I think so, yeah. It's got a lot of the soft stone of Gloucestershire, and the sort of the better known areas where, you know, associated with the royal family and the likes, if you're looking at that way of marketing the country. But we're pretty much bang in the middle of the country, so it's actually commercially a very brilliant position. And it's as a result, it's got a big mixture of people from various different backgrounds and with great stories and histories, and it's a fascinating area.
But you are from London originally.
Well, I was born in London. My family, most of my family comes from Ireland, and then part of my family actually comes from Poland and Austria. So I've labeled myself an Anglo-Irish-Austrian Pole.
So you've got excellent hybrid vigor then.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I fatten very easily.
Don't we all during lockdown? Your parents were Irish then, right?
My father was from the north.
Okay.
And my mother was born in London of an Irish mother. And a second generation immigrant Pole.
Okay.
And they then moved to a little farm just outside Dublin. So she was brought up on the farm. And my father was best described as a renegade Catholic priest.
Okay.
So he was a lot older than my mother, and he came to teach at the convent school that she was attending.
Okay.
The tender age of 16. And I have it. They're both. Well, my mother died a couple of years ago. My father died many, many years ago. But I had it from my mother's best friend at school that the day my father walked into the classroom, my mother just at age 16 just fell madly in love with him.
Wow.
And pursued him and got him in the end.
Right. It's
quite a strange story, especially if you think of that. I mean, I was born in 59, that was happening in the sort of early to mid 50s. It's a whole other world, especially in Ireland, so much stuff that goes with that story. It's fascinating.
So I'm always fascinated by people who have an Anglo-Irish background, and that dynamic between England and Ireland and their intertwined history. Do you feel Irish or do you feel English, or a bit of both?
It's a very good question. In addition to that, my mother, having run away from Ireland with my father, came to London, and she did a few jobs for a year or so before he came over. And she then thought, well, because he was not in the best of health, so she thought, how on earth is she going to support a growing family, because there were two kids. And she'd been a very talented pianist and musician at school. And so she decided to open a shop specializing in Irish music. So we grew up in this intensely Irish atmosphere in many ways with, you know, members of the Chieftains, the Dubliners, the you name it, all sorts of bands just wandering into the shop because we were the kind of a center, a tiny little shop in Camden Town of the Irish community.
Yeah.
So in some respects, extremely Irish, but in others, as you know, as you can hear from the way I talk and where my life is based, extremely British. I don't know. I mean, I in the last few years, I have spent a lot of time on ancestry.co.uk, and that has been absolutely fascinating. And that the hardest one to track back was actually my mother's Irish family, and that all clicked into place during lockdown. And following, I did a DNA test, and I now know I've got a first cousin who's a David Bowie impersonator in Dublin. And, you know, stuff like this, which is fantastic. So it's a real mix. I have an Irish passport, which I suppose I knew I was entitled to, but the looming Brexit encouraged me to make that happen.
Yes.
So I am in some ways split right down the middle. But when I was very young and I went to school in Ireland after my father was taken ill when we were over there, in Ireland I was a Sassenach, and in England, in London, I was a Paddy.
Yeah,
so the best or worst of both worlds, really.
Yeah. So when you were growing up then and you spent some time on family farm just outside Dublin, did you ever consider farming as a career or life at all back then, or, you know, with your family kind of being rooted in that or not?
I did in the sense of being a dreamy little boy. My grandfather owned the slowest racehorse in Ireland, and we used to go and my late grandmother had a chicken enterprise.
Yeah.
And so the farm, which was very tiny, had lots of little chicken houses all over the place because it was a very old-fashioned sort of free-ranging type of setup. And we used to, my then little brother and I used to run around the fields being chased by the racehorse. And he was so slow that, you know, it was just a lovely, lovely time.
Yeah.
So I felt very rooted in the countryside. I always, you know, if anything went wrong with my life, I always attributed it to growing up in London and hating the smell of smoke. And so I suppose I was a dreamy little kid, really. And so I always wanted to find a way to associate myself with the countryside, but for many, many years couldn't find a way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you went to university and studied European and English law. Am I right in thinking you studied in Provence?
I went in the very early years to the University of Buckingham, or it was then called the University College at Buckingham. And my course was in European Studies with focus on law. So the first year was in Buckingham, the second year was in Aix-en-Provence, and then the third year was back in Buckingham. So in the middle year, we did a crunch of the first 2 years of French law legal studies into 1 year, and French language and institutions and European law and European. I mean, it was, you know, given what's going on now, obviously it was a fascinating way of living. And we used to go up to Brussels a lot to sort of traipse around the Bâtiment Berlaymont and the European Court of Justice and in Luxembourg and all of this kind of thing. So I just spanned that time when, traveling abroad was an exciting thing as a youngster. I remember 12 or 13, and it was a very, very big distinction between leaving this island and currency controls. And I think we were allowed to take £100 in cash or something. And there was no concept of, we had no credit cards or no, you know, there was no internationalism at all. And then fast forwarding a few years later at university, suddenly, you know, the world was so much more international, and so the barriers were non-existent almost culturally and physically.
Fantastic. Did you very quickly pick up the language?
I'd been force-fed French from a very, very young age. I remember even in I must have been 5 or 6 when we lived in London. I remember my parents in the holidays had this huge hairy lady who was somewhere from Eastern Europe who used to come in and force French into my brother and myself. And it eventually paid off. I had such a whale of a time in France that I actually failed my exams the first time on the basis of my poor spoken French. I passed everything in writing, but not the oral exams. And I came back to university and I had some French speaking friends and I just said, right, no English for the whole term before I do my retakes. And it just clicked in the Buckinghamshire countryside, bizarrely.
Do you still speak French now?
Badly, but it does come back, yeah. And I then before or after university, I can't remember now, went to the International Interpreter School in Zurich and learned German, which is very, very rusty indeed. But my brother and I've always had a, my brother lives in partly in Rome and partly over here, and he speaks a lot of languages. And I guess we've been blessed with a bit of an ear for it. So it's, I don't use it very often, but it's a joy, definitely.
So how did you end up in the world of investment banking?
When I was very young, I was a bit precocious and I was always arguing with grown-ups. And people kept saying I should become a lawyer because I was good at being ballsy, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I went to the College of Law at Guildford and I hated it. I loved the life I found for myself because I found a nice sort of apartment in the middle of nowhere, and you know it was very much just my attraction to the countryside.
Yeah.
But I hated the studies, and a friend of mine he threw an advertisement at me that was in the White Times looking for graduates for a Japanese investment bank, which no one had heard of at that stage. And he said, "Apply for it. You know, you never know." And it was the only job I applied for. And I wrote up a CV and I got in, and cut a long story, I was one of 12 people taken into this graduate training program for Nomura, which it was, and I guess still is, the largest Japanese investment bank. And I bluffed them unintentionally so to such a degree that they actually didn't send me to Japan on the training program, but they put me straight on a trading desk, not realizing that I knew absolutely nothing about anything. And so that was my sort of baptism of fire for a few years. And then in those days, you know, if you were half capable of doing anything in the bond market, which was mainly what I was involved in, you got headhunted and, you know, salaries raised in multiples of, you know, ridiculous multiples. And that was my life for 12, 14 years, something like that.
So explain to us, for those of us who aren't as clever as you are, explain what do you actually do as an investment banker, or what did you do at that time?
Well, my job was, I mean, the languages were very useful because I was dealing with banks and borrowers of capital all around the world. So my job was raising very large amounts of money for countries, supranational organizations, so like the World Bank or the IADB, or building societies and banks. And I was essentially a relationship manager, pulling all those relationships around. So it was a lot of traveling, a lot of time on the telephone, a lot of dinners and lunches, and a lot of very, very late nights, ranging from in karaoke bars to at the desk.
Yeah, because that was, I guess, was that early 80s when you started?
Yeah, that was 83.
Okay.
83 to 97.
Okay. Yeah. So did you wear the full double-breasted 80s suits and red braces at that time?
No red braces. Interestingly, the link between, the suits were all right. My brother worked for Paul Smith, so I wore a natty Smith suit that came to me at discount prices. But no, I never wore the braces. I'm sure we'll come to it, but when I started this business, the meat and farm shop business, I started it just after I was made redundant in the summer of 97, and started it by October of that year. Come February, I was going bust. And I was sitting in my little office upstairs thinking, you know, this is it, what's going to happen? And the phone went, and it was a researcher for On Your Farm that used to go out at 6:35 on a Sunday morning on Radio 4. And they needed a farm to come to that week. And so they came to me, and it was Oliver Woolston, who I haven't spoken to him for years, but I've had a couple of correspondences with his son, who's quite active on Twitter.
Yeah, I've interviewed him on the podcast.
Oliver was what a character. I hadn't met him, but I'd read his articles and what have you. And he said to me when he arrived, he said, it started, and he was very aggressive, because he thought I was just, you know, what, and why wouldn't he? He was looking for the red braces and the Porsche, he said. And after a while, he realized that I neither had red braces nor Porsche, and I actually was producing some incredible food and doing some incredible things. And if you ever listen to it, you hear him switch gear from being quite aggressive and almost nasty is too strong a word, but quite negative.
Yeah.
Suddenly realize, no, this is serious. This guy is really trying to do something special. And that interview saved my bacon, literally, turned the business around. It went out on the Sunday morning, and people started arriving half an hour after it finished. On the Sunday, it was quite extraordinary, and we built up the most amazing client base through by virtue of it.
Mm. Okay, so just to take you back to the investment banking, I mean, did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy the career? You obviously worked in it for what, 17, 18 years? What were some of the
About 14 years. I arrived in it really not knowing one end of anything from another. By a series of chances, I ended up in quite senior roles. I had a love-hate relationship with it.
Yeah.
The traveling was extraordinary. The intensity of it, the passion, that the money was terrific. Although I was never one of the sort of multi-million pound bonus earners, I did very well. I learned a lot. There's a lot that I should have learned that I didn't, and a lot that I did learn that has stood me, I think, in quite good stead. Mm-hmm. But the only thing I've ever missed really is the money. The good people I've retained their friendships. The less good people, but no, I don't miss them.
No,
it was certainly an extraordinary experience, and like a lot of things that, you know, as you get a little bit older, you think it's your all-consuming life. It does consume you entirely at the time, and you can't see another life the other side of it. And I think here and now, with everything we're all going through, you learn even more than ever to both live for that moment, but also not forget about how different things could be, be it penury or pandemic.
Yeah. So during that time working in banking, I guess you always had that hankering to get back to the country, though, didn't you?
Yeah. I bought, after a few years, I bought a small holding out in the Fens, little farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, just in from the Wash, with a few acres of grass. And I was rather addicted to horses. I was very good at falling off them a lot. But I loved breeding them and, you know, working with the young stock and what have you. And then because it was a very small grassland holding, the grass started to suffer from just having horses on. So I decided, I'll get a cow. And I'd read an old book, Stephen's Book of the Farm, which was published in the late 1800s. Very, very wonderful collection. I don't know if you know it, but
yes, yeah, so I read it after, what was that program that was on a few years ago, Victorian Farm?
Oh yes,
I remember seeing that, and they talked about it a lot on there, didn't they?
So well, I was way ahead of them. And what happened was I went for various reasons, I went up to Scotland And in the library of the house I was staying in was a copy of it. Okay. And I sat down and I'd just been deciding that I needed to get a cow to munch away at this longer grass. And so I read through the description of all the breeds at the time, and I decided on the Dexter. So I came home and I bought my first Dexter, and I knew nothing. I mean, I'd been loosely associated with cattle as a young boy, but I bought one heifer who promptly kept running away, and the local farmer would bring her back. And, you know, I couldn't get near her. The local farmer would bring her back in the back of his pickup.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, you really need to get another one. So I got another one, and then another one, and then another one. And at one stage, I must have had, I think, pretty much the largest herd of Dexters in the country. I had about 250 head.
Yeah.
And when I came to Northfield, we were just ready to start killing some of the fat stock. And that timing coincided with my redundancy. And I'd already started to put a little farm shop stroke cold room in, really intending to just open it once in a blue moon. And I went and collected the first carcass in. I mean, lots of people have gone through this experience, but, you know, loaded them all, everything into the boot of my car. And I didn't know what to do with the beef. So I just drove around giving bits away.
Yeah.
That started the business.
Yeah. So when you were made redundant in 1997 and you decided that you would make a full-time living out of farming, how did you decide on what you were going to produce and the way you were going to produce and sell it?
Well, I'd been here at Northfield for just under 3 years when that happened. I was building up this herd of Dexters, and it was really just, there was no inspiration, it was all inspiration and no plan, really. I just thought BSE mm-hmm. was raging.
Of course.
And at the time, the Dexter was the only breed of cow that could say definitively, or did say definitively, that it had never had a case. So I thought, you know, that's a piece of good fortune to take advantage of. So I carried on buying Dexters, and I just thought, well, we'll just, you know, I'll educate myself about lamb in due course and about pigs in due course, and we'll just try and ride this wave of interest in proper food, in proper meat. The beef on the bone ban was the best thing that ever happened to little businesses like mine at the time. And it became the regular, you know, people, the code was people coming in to buy meat for their dog, because it wasn't illegal to feed dogs beef on the bone. So it had this extraordinary secret code at butchers and farm shops all around the country.
Yeah.
Saying I'd like a whole sirloin for my dog on the bone, please.
Yeah.
I mean, a friend of mine, you asked earlier about the sort of pre-city and post-city mm-hmm. banking. A friend of mine phoned me up and he said, right, I've sent the wife out to buy another freezer. This is just after the news had gone live with the beef on the bone ban. And he said, how much can you send me? You know, people were doing that. They were so outraged at being told that they couldn't take responsibility for where their food came from and how they ate it. I mean, there's interesting parallels, I suppose, with the whole mask debate, which is a whole other issue. But for little people like me, little producers and people beginning in that and struggling in back then, it was the focus. It was probably the sharpest focus on the realities of meat and quality and what have you. And then then came Borough Market, which I'm sure you like to talk about, and the people associated with that really started a transformation, which is still, you know, it's stalled, I think, to a certain extent, mm-hmm. although bizarrely COVID may well have helped revive that transformation.
Yeah. Did you always plan to have a shop on the farm?
No, I think I was 37 when the redundancy hit.
Yeah.
And by the standards of the time, 37 was old. I was over the hill, because the market, well, in many ways, the the foundations for the 07-08 crash were being laid back then. And what was happening was, I'm not especially bright, and I was definitely not an especially bright banker. I was good at relationships. I was good at getting on with people, and I was almost an old school relationship manager. What was happening at that time was you had a massive transformation towards very highly complicated transactions with the swaps and derivatives market. And I used to consider myself to be even dumber than I subsequently realized, because I struggled to understand a lot of these things. But actually, the reason I couldn't understand a lot of them was they actually made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, right.
And they were setting down the very weak foundations for the future of banking, which then caused the massive credit crunch and crash in 07, 08,
yeah,
with credit derivatives and just a very blinkered focus on getting deals done, and sort of almost a total distancing from the real world. I hadn't ever thought about learning how to cut up a carcass or anything like that. But I was made redundant, and I looked around and I thought, well, my star is waning at the old age of 37. What else can I do? I didn't really want to end up. I'd seen a lot of people who'd done very, very well, and then they ended up working for smaller and smaller institutions. Not that that necessarily matters, but doing, frankly, selling their souls to something they no longer believed in.
Yeah, sure.
And so I was here. I bought the farm 3 years ago. 3 years previously, and I thought, well, I'll try and make it pay. I may never manage, but I don't want to look back and think I should have had a go.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
Yeah. Now, is there anything that you know now about direct selling your own produce, whether it be through the shop or a pro market, that you wish you'd known then?
Yeah, everything.
I wondered if you'd say that.
Everything. Would I have still done it had I known how tough it's been?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, some of the things have been so ridiculous. Sorry, I'm going to shut my... I've got WhatsApp on. I'm going to shut that down.
It's okay. It's
making that noise. Some of the stuff that has happened has been so brutal. But, you know, brutal stuff happens, mm-hmm, whether you're stuck behind a desk or,
of course, yeah,
a tractor or whatever. Mm. Yeah, I've learned a hell of a lot. I think I hope I've become a bit more humble. One of the few things that it may have helped, but I'm sure lots of people would say that's not true.
So tell us how you first got involved with Borough Market, and for those listening again who might be overseas, maybe in this country, who've never been to Borough Market, maybe tell us a bit about it.
Well, Borough Market, there's been a market at or around London Bridge in the City of London for around 1,000 years. Borough Market in its current position has been there for about 260 years. A lot of people have heard of Smithfield Market in the north, and that's where goose breeders from Norfolk would, you know, put their flocks through tar tubs to coat their feet and walk them slowly over a period of weeks down to London to market. Cattle would come in, sheep would come in, pigs would come in. Well, Borough was the equivalent for the south, and in particular because of its access to the southeast, was a very much a sort of a place for vegetable growers and marketers to bring their produce in and sell to, generally, to on sellers, so as a sort of intermediary location. About 250, 260 years ago, it was shut down, because it just descended into, like a lot of markets, into issues of whoring and debauchery. The people of Borough, of Southwark, missing their market, gathered money together. And they bought a small piece of land, literally a small triangle of land, and that was awarded the a Royal Charter to reinstate Borough Market in perpetuity. And my business down there is located on that triangle of land alongside one other farming business and a family fishing business. And around that, then over the subsequent couple of hundred years, the market, it became a charitable trust. It expanded. It owns a lot of property. And it's roughly, I think, a 6 or 7 acre site. Mm-hmm. Right next to London Bridge Station. And the current structure is a very beautiful Victorian structure with massive cast iron pillars.
Yeah.
The trustees of Borough Market a number of years ago had extraordinary foresight, and I believe they bought from Covent Garden Market. They bought part of the facade of Covent Garden Market, and I believe they paid £1 for it. And it lay in storage for decades. And then about 15 years ago, with a lot of redevelopment of London Bridge, the market itself was redeveloped, and this frontage, which is now internationally recognised as being Borough Market, although it came from Covent Garden, was installed as an integral part of the new structure of Borough, looking forward and looking back, which is quite exceptional. So I was, despite Oliver Woolston's best endeavours, life was a struggle. We started doing a local farmers market just at, I think it was Shepshed was the first ever farmers market, certainly in Leicestershire. We did that, and that was a whole new experience. We then did Loughborough, and we were dealing with, a lot of the time it was busloads of pensioners coming along, and we were trying to sell our product at a price that actually made us some degree of profit. And frankly, a lot of these people were coming, they had been sort of buying sausages from the supermarket full of rubbish and for many, many years, and they were saying, well, you know, I can't possibly afford these prices. And my ex-wife, with whom I started the business, was and is a phenomenally talented cook and has a real instinct with food. So she took it upon herself. She started creating budgets for these particular pensioners that used to come every week and start grumbling. And she'd show them how to live with our produce on, you know, £6 or £8 a week or whatever. And we sort of grew this understanding of you know, it's about quality, not quantity. And you know, one sausage for certain people, it wouldn't sustain me, but for many people, one sausage and an egg and is a perfectly acceptable meal. But we were still struggling, and I'd got involved with Slow Food in a very small way, which is, for those that don't know, is an international organization that stemmed from a rebellion against McDonald's in Italy. Yeah. And Slow Food's a very, it's got great strengths and it's got certain weaknesses in terms of it. It's a very, very much about the philosophy of food, and in some regards, less about the practicality of food and farming. But it's extremely well motivated and has achieved a lot, I think, for small producers around the world. And the then head of Slow Food UK phoned me up one day, and she said, look, there's something happening at this place called Borough Market, just near London Bridge, and I think you really need to look into it. And the most influential person involved in it back then was Randolph Hodgson, who started Neal's Yard Dairy. And any cheese-producing farmers in this country kind of owe their existence to Randolph.
Yep.
He was a very charismatic, very foresightful chap who pretty much single-handedly saved and relaunched the British cheese industry. Mm-hmm. And he and another great character, Peter Gott of Silfield Farm up in Cumbria, they were really the two sort of moving forces behind Borough. And what Henrietta Green, the author of The Food Lover's Guide to Great Britain, had put a Food Lover's Festival together, and Clarissa Dixon Wright and Jennifer Patterson, the two fat ladies, were the sort of celebrity personalities to open it. And they launched this at Borough Market in September, October, autumn 1998. And Henrietta had just discovered Northfield and written a charming article about us in Country Living magazine, and but actually forgot to invite me to trade at the very first borough event. But I contacted Randolph in February of 99, and he came and visited the farm and checked us out, a bit like Oliver had done. And he invited us down, and we were the first people to cook at Borough Market. We didn't have a fridge van. We had a Land Rover, and we had a stock trailer, and we hosed out the stock trailer, and that we put our servo over counter in that, and our fridge boxes, insulated boxes, and we drove down to London, put the children with someone or other, and I bought a little gas barbecue, and we hand pressed, 1,000 burgers or something, and we sold out. And I still remember Randolph from the other side of the crowds around us buying fresh meat and buying our cooked product, going, "So you're coming back next month, are you?" Because it was only monthly, and it was the third Saturday of the month.
Yeah,
and it grew from there, and it has. Without Borough, I'd have no roof over my head. Without Borough, there is so much that wouldn't have happened. Yeah. And it's been a rocky, rocky ride down there for lots of reasons. Mm-hmm. And right now it's, it's a fascinating but very difficult experience. Mm-hmm. But it is an extraordinary place and has been an extraordinary place in my life for over 21 years now. It's 21 years ago since we first traded there.
It is an extraordinary place, isn't it? I mean, when I go to London, I got family there, and I always like going to the Museum of London and seeing how London's changed over the millennia. And I always think that if you could pick up a Roman Londoner and put them in Borough Market, and they would recognise the scene and the process. Mm. It seems like a very real link to the past somehow, doesn't it? Is that just me being a romantic history nerd, or would...
No, I don't think so. I think I like to write when I find time, and I don't find much time. But a number of years ago, Borough Market is twinned with the Boqueria in Barcelona, which is also an extraordinary food market. And a number of years ago, a group of us went to trade for a weekend at the Boqueria, and the trustees very kindly organised an Arctic to take all our refrigerated counters and everything down. And then we flew down, and then we unloaded them, and we traded at the Boqueria. And I remember getting down there, as I often did, at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, the Cumbrian mafia, we used to refer to them as the farmers from Cumbria, would come down. When they built their fridges, they built little shelves to slide in and sleep.
Yeah.
Because you either slept, we couldn't afford hotels, so we either slept in these hidden areas of the fridge, or in our vans. And I remember the atmosphere in those early, early hours was unlike anything I've ever experienced. And I suppose, being a bit of I like to feel the mysticism of a place, the sense of place in those early hours was quite extraordinary. There was a real sense of hundreds and hundreds of years of people doing much the same as we were doing, whether it was horse or cart or a battered old Sprinter van or whatever, in essence, there was no difference. So I think it is quite extraordinary. I mean, it's changed a lot because it has been the outside of the market. The rented properties have, to a certain extent, been taken over and threatened almost by very big financial interests. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see how that changes, if it changes. Its survival is I wouldn't say it's in question, but it's certainly an issue at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's not shut down throughout, so the virus hasn't hit it in that way, but it's been a very, very difficult trading time for a lot of producers, and still is. There are some. We're lucky that we have an everyday staple. Our meat is something that people want to eat, or many, many people want to eat, not just as a treat, but every day. And so that has stood us in very good stead. And we were part of the launch of a home delivery service from the market itself, and that went ballistic during the worst of this time we've been living through. Mm-hmm. But it needs support. It needs people to think, develop, like anything in food. You've got the supermarkets and big business, and then you've got, I'm always trying to get people to engage with who they buy their food from. I wrote some terrible thing a few years ago, which I called the rule of least remove, which is buy your food from as close a place and as close a relationship as you possibly can, whatever it is. Have as few intermediaries in from where that's produced to where you consume it, and your life will be richer and better and more informed and culturally more rounded, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to come on to that shortly. talk us through a typical day at Borough Market. I guess you leave the farm at incredibly early, or you did back then. How has it changed since you first?
Well, back originally, we'd had to go down, set up for the day, take our kit with us, set up for the day, clear up, and go away again.
Yeah, okay.
Then, so we were doing one day a month. Then we did one day a week, and then we gradually, from Saturdays, expanded it back up the week to Fridays and Saturdays, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Wednesday. So, but for many years now, we've had a permanent cage, as it used to be called, stand, as it's called now, within this magic triangle. And so we have a team of people. My youngest son runs it down there, much to everyone's astonishment. He uncovered in his late teens a passion for butchery and cooking and food, and which has been a blessing, obviously, for us as a family. So he lives down there. He comes to the farm whenever he can. The day can start as early as 4 o'clock in the morning, rarely any later than sort of 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. We have a butchery area. We hang carcasses down there. We make small batches of sausages and what have you. Most of the production is done up at the farm. So we have a van that drives down a couple of times a week to deliver down there. If suddenly we're busier or run out of something, we'll dash down. It's about a 2 to 3 hour journey each way from here. His brother goes down most weekends on a Friday morning, leaving the farm at 3:30, 4 o'clock, and then they trade through till maybe 6 o'clock in the evening, and then again on the Saturday. There's a real sense of community down there, particularly among the traders that have been there for a longer time. It's very special.
And what about the range of products that you're selling there? It's expanded considerably over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, our principal staples have always been beef, pork, and lamb. We've always done a bit of poultry, which we buy in. Our sausage business is quite substantial. And then to try and even up the carcass balance, we were the first people to be cooking down there. So we've always, that's been a very big part of the business. And that's the part that with coronavirus has been stopped in its tracks. Sure. So we have started that again in a very small way with our events trailer, but we're doing maybe 10% of what we used to do. So that's the area with the highest margin, so it puts a big strain on the business. In the very early years of Borough, there were obviously Clarissa was a great supporter, and she became a very close friend of mine and the family. Jamie Oliver was he did all his weekly shopping with us. And I remember Tatler magazine, of all things, listed in their top 10 things to do in London was stand next to Jamie Oliver queuing for a burger at Northfield Farm.
Is that right? Yeah.
It was pretty crazy.
Of course, in his early TV career, he used to see, was it The Naked Chef? He used to see him sort of skipping around Borough Market.
Yeah, didn't you? And it was true. You know, he used to buy a lot of lamb from us.
Yeah.
And he was very, very friendly and very down to earth. And you know, obviously then he kind of sold his soul to Sainsbury's to start with. But he has done a huge amount for food and for food producers. You can't knock it. It's just that difficult, you know, commerciality of life is a really difficult thing. And you know, restaurant chains which then collapse, or, you know, supermarket contracts which maybe, you know, achieve other things. I don't know. It's a very difficult balance. But he was definitely very, very important in the early years of the market, and was almost synonymous with the market for quite a period of time. I mean, a lot of cooks, celebrity or otherwise, have come and gone with their association. A lot of them, unfortunately, I think it's true with very few exceptions, they want to associate themselves either with a place like Burra or with individual producers, but they're very rarely actually committed to those producers. They tend to talk the talk but not walk the walk, or whichever way around that works. And we've had a lot of encounters over the years. We've dealt with a lot of high profile cooks and chefs and restaurants and hotels, and frankly, that's not been a good experience for us. I think it has been for others.
Yeah.
So I decided that we would focus on direct relationships with our retail customers, be they buying 6 sausages a week or be they spending hundreds of pounds a week, because that's the lifestyle they lead. And I think in general, it's not the route to fame or fortune, but it gives a fairly solid base to the business, or as solid as it can be.
Yeah. Is that one of your favorite parts of the job, that relationship with those customers who you've maybe bought produce from you for years? Maybe they come back every year.
Yeah.
I don't
stand behind the counter very often at all for lots of reasons anymore, but I did for many, many years. I kind of self-taught and picked people's brains in terms of butchery. And yeah, the client aspect of it in some ways was very much, you know, what I took from my previous life as a banker.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, here on the farm, I like to be around I'm here all the time at the moment, but I like to be around on a Friday or Saturday when it's our busiest days, because it is lovely to see people who have been shopping since the beginning.
Yeah.
People who, when I started, there was someone in just the other day who's, you know, big, big business, very high profile. And the stuff that he did for us in terms of kindness, and there are many people that come here in the early years, I try never to forget that kind of thing and never to take it for granted. And it's lovely to see those people again. Partly, I think they're coming back because they've been reminded, despite life being so difficult, that actually supporting people like us, and it's not just us, by any means, is actually, it has a value in its own right, culturally and in terms of local economy and reciprocity and what have you. And socially, you know, it's knowing the people you buy from, and then some people bump into their friends when they're here. I mean, our farm shop here is very modest. It's very tiny. It's just in an old converted sort of little stable block. But it's very special, I think.
Okay. I just want to get on to an incident that happened to you in 2006. Can't talk to you without discussing this. When you Google it, you've done interviews with newspapers and things like that. You had a serious accident, didn't you?
I was, big part of the business was festivals until this year. And we used to do a lovely festival called Guildfest down in Guildford. And I used to do that myself. And I'd come back from a weekend and got back on the, I think it was the Monday. Someone was doing some mowing for us in the backfield, and my kids weren't at home. And I went out to see how it was going, and cut a long story short, I ended up under the back of the tractor, folded in two, with a broken hip and smashed pelvis. And I was airlifted to the Leicester Royal and spent 2 months on my back after a very difficult, extraordinary operation. It wasn't what anyone would expect at the beginning of a day.
No. So, I mean, do you remember it happening? Or did you kind of...
Yeah. No, I remember it very clearly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess, stupid question, perhaps, in absolute agony?
Yeah. There's nothing, no words to describe it or experience like it. I was certain I was dying. I wrote a book about it to really, because it affected me obviously physically, but it affected me mentally. The experience of recovering from it, the proximity to death. And we all read about, you know, especially right now, lots of extraordinary people who've come very close to death through through their COVID experiences. Well, this was just another occasion that someone has come very close to death. But I suppose it's very topical. I was blown away by the extraordinary kindness within the NHS, but also the extraordinary comparisons and inefficiencies and horrors, frankly, within it. I suppose when you have a very close to death experience, you think, you know, what hadn't I done that I would have, you know, as my soul was departing this earth, that I would have thought, you know, sod it, I wish I'd done it. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy writing. I think I write reasonably well, and I never do enough of it, either for my own pleasure or for any other purpose. And I thought my head was in a very bad place. I was addicted to painkillers very substantially. The ongoing pain for years and years was excruciating. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot about painkiller addiction and actually the uselessness of painkillers, which a lot more has been learned about that since. And I thought the only way I can somehow get my head clear on this is actually to write about it. Mm-hmm. And so I sat down and started writing, and it did have a very cathartic effect. An unexpected byproduct of it was that two of my children, my eldest and my youngest, got quite involved in helping me with it, because my daughter was at Oxford Brookes doing a course in English and publishing, and so she helped me with the technological side. And my youngest, Dominic, he proofread the whole thing, so if there are any mistakes, it's his fault. Bless him, he was only probably 10 or something at the time. But you know, little things, there's like so many of us are doing at the moment, you pull whatever positive you can out of stuff. Yeah. And you know, would I write that kind of thing now? Probably not. I haven't reread it for years. Occasionally people read it and give me their thoughts. But the process of writing it, the process of publishing it, and the process of entering into a bit of a dialogue about it with a number of people was very beneficial. I was determined to find the helicopter crew that rescued me, you know, as I emerged. You know, there were the steps that I wanted to give thanks and what have you. And the local air ambulance thought they had rescued me, because there was a lot of publicity about it. And it turned out they hadn't. It turned out it was the police. Okay. It was the police helicopter that came and got me. I eventually tracked them down, and so the photograph on the back of the book is actually them. They dropped in. They just caught a criminal in Leicester and phoned me up, and because I've been trying to have contact with them, and they'd phoned me at one stage, and I had broken down on the phone. I'd really struggled to talk with them. I suppose it's all sort of mental health and what have you. And so one Sunday, I was sitting here feeling a bit sorry for myself, and the pilot phoned and said who he was, and said, we'd like to come and see you. And I said, yeah, sure. When do you want to come? And he said, well, we're about 2 minutes away. Okay. Shall we land in the place where we picked you up? And I said, yeah. Wow. And they came and they bought some sausages and had a cup of tea. And they just doing that transformed my, it was like something clicked. And so I think there is a very bad misunderstanding or lack of understanding of some of the things that can help people who've been in very traumatic physical situations, and understanding the importance of looking after their mind and the whole person. And so inadvertently those guys did an extraordinary thing for me, because that was a real turning point. But yeah, as a whole, it's been it was and continues to be a limiting factor, but also in some ways very enriching. I mean, the people that I met at the Royal in Leicester who cared for me. A lot of them I talk probably far more openly about than I would now in this environment. They were amazing, amazing people. Dealt very poorly by, I think, by the then regime, just as to a large extent they are still today.
Yeah.
But the Nursing Times did a lovely review and called it my love letter to the NHS, which was another sweet and important step.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people who go through these extremely traumatic experiences talk about it sort of changing their perspective on life. Is that what happened to you as well?
I think it's probably better. I think it's very difficult to judge oneself. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the reality is, yes, of course, you have this initially, this extraordinary, oh my gosh, you know, isn't this a beautiful sunset? And isn't that bird singing beautifully? And that bud on the tree is a thing of great wonder. Inevitably, there is a change, but inevitably that change, the brightness of the light that shines dims a bit over time. So I don't think of it, you know, then for many years, I thought about it almost every moment of every day. And that's why it screwed me up so badly. Yeah. So it's gaining some distance from it is very important. Mm. I think understanding the kindness, again, I sound a bit like a broken record, but I'd never, you know, you have, as a child, if you're lucky, you have, you know, you experience parental or sibling or, you know, family kindnesses, and whatever else happens to you, you get exposed to different degrees of cruelty or kindness. But the extremity of the kindness and the sacrifice of the people that cared, not all of them, but the majority of them that cared for me and that I witnessed caring for others was, I think that was the biggest life-changing thing. And that understanding of this extraordinary institution that we have, I suppose I feel guilty that I've not done more than write a few paragraphs about it, really. But it is, you know, I've been through it again. I had some other complications a couple of years ago. And then my mother sadly went through all sorts of, you know, traumatic things around, at the end of her life. And, you know, now more than ever, the NHS and what it's achieved and what it's still battling to achieve and may well again this winter is an extraordinary thing. And I mean, I'm not politically involved in anything, but I've always found this clapping for the NHS I found as an absolutely, frankly, a travesty. I think it's about doing real stuff and real appreciation. And that's what we need to do and understand, and to have a government that it has to be dragged into stuff like, you know, whether it's wages, whether it's a proper appreciation, whether it's structural, whether it's funding, it's beyond me. I find it very, very difficult to comprehend.
Mm. Must have been incredibly difficult for your family as well. Young family, I guess, at that time. I mean, you know, it must have been an awfully long process just to get back on your feet, I guess.
Yeah, it was. I'd been through a divorce a few years beforehand. And of my three children, one tended to spend most of her time with their mother. Leo, my farming son, as I call him, spent most of his time with me, and his younger brother floated between the two. There was a certain symmetry to that. Leo was 13 at the time, and he really took over caring for me and for, you know, starting to farm at the age of 13. So he'd get up very early. He'd make sure because I couldn't, you know, I had to learn to walk again. So he'd make sure I was all right, feed me, feed the animals outside, go to school, come back and do the reverse of it at the end of the day. And so there's a lot, you know, it's a lot that a child ideally shouldn't have to do for or see in terms of pain. And you know, fortunately he was a big lad, so he was able to physically help me get around. But you know, I was shuffling up and down the stairs on my backside, and you know, it was a tough thing for all three of them. I mean, you know, I suppose it brought us all a lot closer in some ways, and they've always looked out for me. Very, you know, I'm pretty mobile now, though I have my time, but for many years I wasn't. And the funny thing that still happens occasionally is I can be tripped up by a little pebble and go flying. Fortunately, I bounce still most of the time. But you know, they, all three of them have always been very. They've adjusted to that. They'd like a sixth sense. They will. I mean, it's less important now, but then for many years, they'd see something, they'd anticipate something that might hurt me. So the roles were in a way reversed. They were protecting me and looking after me, which is a very, you know, it's a very special experience for me, if not for them.
Accidents like this are all too common in farming. I mean, it's, I think it's Farm Safety Week this week as we're recording. Why do you think that is? Why do we have such a poor record in the agriculture industry?
I think farmers are, whether they've come to it later in life like me or from, I think they are slightly a breed apart. And we all think we're younger than we are. We all think we're far more indestructible than we really are. We tend to, because as it gets harder and harder and harder to earn a crust, we tend to, which is true across a lot of businesses, we tend to run faster.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a well-worn saying that, you know, a very important part of farming, livestock farming or arable, which I know far less about, is spent standing at the gate, looking at your crop, looking at your stock. And we don't get enough time to do that. And I think that is part and parcel of it. I think also in general in life, it's these tiny little things. I mean, no one knows who's, and it's not about fault in the case of what happened to me, but you know, at the heart of it, I should have taken precautions. Although I wasn't running the tractor, I should have taken precautions before I got under to examine what this funny noise was. And so we need to take responsibility for ourselves in lots of different walks of life, but in particular in farming.
Yeah.
Think before we leap, or think before we act, or think before we jump in or out of a machine or whatever. I think it's very difficult to train for it, but I think it's almost a philosophical approach that's needed. And just as there's lots of things that we all need re-educating about as a society, I think it's that understanding of how suddenly stuff can change and how dramatically we can be affected. And I think that is maybe something that needs to be taught, not just in farming, but across the board, just as, you know, schools need to teach more about business and mortgages and interest rates and lending and quality. And, you know, there's so much that's missing from our very basic curriculum. I think it's almost a philosophical approach that we all need to acquire, not just in farming, because until you have been through it, there is no way you can understand how suddenly things can change.
Okay, let's get back to something more cheerful. Let's talk about your livestock. What breeds of pig, sheep and cattle are you running there?
Well, for a long time, as I said, we had a very large herd of little Dexters. And they were, I mean, it's still one of our most popular products. People are desperate for the beef. It is a very sweet, very lovely product. But when Leo, you know, after my accident, as you know, I was clearly not going to get back to a great deal of physical farming for a long time, and so we acquired a native Angus cow with a very nice bull calf at foot, and we made the first step. We kept the bull calf entire, and he was a fabulous bull. And we started using him on the Dexters, because the Dexter is unusual in that it can take a much larger bull and still calve incredibly easily. And so the quality of our carcasses took a step up through that combination. And it was an interesting one, because this was not a great, big, massive, modern Angus. This was a compact, still big, you know, probably double the size of a half-decent Dexter bull.
Yeah.
But then we decided that actually because we were trying to survive financially as well as in terms of the quality and story, that actually the time came to move towards a more commercial animal. And it has to be said that as part of the divorce, I needed to raise money. And so it coincided with a lovely friend of mine who has a business down in Somerset, who wanted to expand into Dexter's. And he came and bought half the herd, including the finest bull we ever had, which was a lovely, lovely Dexter bull. And so there was a kind of a move then to Angus's. And so we went, we'd always had a couple of white parks knocking about, and we'd also put the Angus bull on those when we didn't have a white park bull. And so we started going up to Stirling. We started visiting a lot of Angus breeders who were incredibly kind to us. And we started buying some very, very high quality pedigree Angus stock and expanded into that. And that just makes it, you know, the killing cost is the same. Actually, the time and effort butchering is much the same for a carcass that's almost twice the size. And we were still doing the same things that we'd always done, which is slow growing, substantially grass fed. And it just made much more commercial sense. And then more recently, although we've not got very many, you know, I focused a lot more on the White Park and the crossing of it as you're aware. And we'd always wanted to have this traditional breed stroke rare breed stroke native breed focus, which is important for the quality of the product, but also the story and the way it fits into the landscape and the farming system and the type of grass and all of that. And I think it's a very, very important thing to do. I think in the 70s, there was a lot of focus on, you know, the grass being greener elsewhere. So focus on Limousin and Charolais and these fast finishing, to my view, incredibly ugly animals. I know that'll offend lots of people because I'm very good friends with some of them. But to the cost of at the cost of native breeds, when we first left London, our landlords were, we rented a little cottage. He had a wonderful herd of traditional Herefords, and which would be originally from sort of kind of close to where you hail from, I guess. And I think they probably, although I've never owned any, they probably instilled the beginning of an understanding of the what are now rare breeds or have become rare breeds. And then I had Dartmoor sheep, grey-faced Dartmoor sheep, which were a lot of fun and, again, a fabulous product. But Leo's tended to keep the roots with the heritage-type breeds and the native breeds, but aim towards a bit more commerciality. And so we've got a lot of Clins now. I experimented with Border Leicesters, who I adore, but are very hard work, albeit very lovely to look at. And then we've had some Hampshire Down tups we've used. And so there's a lot of experimenting to produce great carcasses, really. We had pigs for a while. We had Gloucester Old Spots. And then for a long time, we had British Lops, which is one of the rarest rare breeds. But we're not really set up for it. The land is very heavy to have them out all the time.
Okay.
They're a great attraction. People love seeing them. Mm-hmm. So we mainly rely on other people to rear and supply us with good pork.
Sure. Okay. What about your wool? Topical subject at the moment. Much discussion in the farming press and on social media. Why is such an amazing product so criminally undervalued, and what can we do about it? Big question, I know.
It is a big question. And I think it's partly, I suppose I use those phrases a lot, philosophical and cultural and partly commercial. I think the COVID-19 has put the spotlight on sustainability and the environment. I mean, even here, and we think of ourselves as being in a very rural location, the horizon, I think it's stretched by a factor of two. I think it doubled during those lockdown, intense lockdown periods. Because obviously being incredibly lucky, we've got space to walk and what have you. And my daughter and I would walk two or three times a day, you know, in various parts of the farm. And I'm certain we could see further right the way through it. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to say, talk about pollution levels coming down and, you know, far less blame on cows and sheep for farting and their responsibility for climate disaster. I think the role of plastics in our everyday lives, and especially in our clothes and in our carpets and in everything that goes around us, and also the ephemeral nature of what we buy. You know, there's a big sort of battle obviously going on between the West and China at the moment, and you know, buying rubbish, frankly. There is a clothing wise especially, there is a great trend among the young, I feel very old saying that, but to buy the disposable culture.
Yeah.
So I think that's a starting point. I think it would be a relatively inexpensive way of supporting agriculture for some of the boosts that are being planned to the economy. For example, to look at regional centres that process the product. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll have seen on social media as I have, you know, piles of wool sitting in sacks. I've seen farmers using it as compost and composting it, putting it on their veg patches. We've got it, our little crop of wool sitting in sacks and not sure what to do with. Last couple of years, we've had very small dealings with a lady who was experimenting with processing some of our fleeces into really interesting things like shrouds. And you know, there's a lot that could be done with it, but it needs funding. But it doesn't actually need that much funding, and it needs a few entrepreneurial people to look at the business case. I mean, the longevity of a well-made woolen jumper, for example, it's not too cold at the moment, but I mean, I bought this English woolen jumper, has no brand on it, has no details of actually where it came from, but it's got a Union Jack on it somewhere. It's bomb-proof. It goes in it. It's part of my working life, and you know, subject to the temperature, it probably gets put on almost every day of the year.
Yeah.
And it still looks like it did two or three years ago when I bought it. And it's educating people away from it. But I think there could be very quickly and very easily a study put together and funding put into something for looking at how to process it and make better stuff with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some great accounts. As I don't know if you followed Dodgson Wood, is it up in Cumbria?
Yes.
They use a lot of James Rebank's wool.
That's right, yeah.
I've never met him, but he's a bit of a hero of mine in terms of how he presents farming and how he educates people. You know, and their products are absolutely fantastic to look at. I haven't bought anything yet, but it's like everything. It needs a bit of innovation. It needs bringing back into our culture that this is something. You know, it's the whole of medieval Britain was based on wool. The churches were built out of the proceeds of wool.
Yeah.
Most of the fortunes, you know, for many, many centuries were based on wool. And it's such a great product.
Yeah. I mean, farmers used to pay the rent check wool, didn't they?
You know, I think it's, you know, at a time when we're supposedly making Britain great again, there's a deep cultural need to do something to rectify that, because it's wrong. The current situation is just we have to have a sense in politically and in business and culturally of right and wrong. It's a bit trite, but it's not, you know, the right versus left. It's what's right, what's correct, and what's not. And this level of waste, when you've got all the other costs that are invisible with plastic fleeces and what have you. I mean, it leads into a whole other sort of bugbear of mine, which is true cost analysis. And when you start to analyze the true cost of poor food, poor products, the use of plastics in clothing, suddenly you find actually that woolen garment and even the cost of producing it and the cost of supporting the communities that produce it because there's no proper analysis. We have a total misunderstanding of what cost really constitutes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, and our understanding is so much greater now, isn't it? With things like microfibers in the oceans and everywhere, really, as you say, that sort of disposable clothing model, it's just no longer sustainable, is it? So seems like now is the time for wool, doesn't it? The resurgence of this incredible
trend.
So we've hinted at it a bit, but tell us about the effect of COVID on the business.
If you I think probably like most businesses, when this started, I was actually in Italy when it happened. My late mother had a little apartment in the middle of nowhere, and I was down there trying to paint it and get away and think about stuff. And it was when I drove down in early February, and it was a factor, but it didn't feel, there was no clear message that this was life-changing.
Yeah.
And within days of getting there, it was clear that it was, and particularly in it, I was in sort of middle of Italy and hearing what was happening in the north and what have you. And so I made the decision on the day to escape, and that night they closed the borders. I got out 45 minutes before they shut the border, and very stupidly was driving along thinking, oh, this is good. There are not many people wandering around, so the Italians are going to do some road maintenance. And then as I saw more and more as I got to the border, I thought, no, they're about to close the border. When I got back, obviously, I although there were no precautions and no insistence, really, I isolated myself within the house. And I think initially there was a bit of, if I'm honest, there was a sense of just incredulity and panic almost, because we were just about to go into the beginning of our event season where we cook all our burgers and stuff, and that shut down. The cooking operation at Borough Market shut down overnight. And at that stage, we didn't know whether we were going to see a resurgence in interest in what I would call proper food and meat. And so there was a sort of lull for a week or two where there was this massive drop in income and a sort of bubbling uncertainty on the possible increase in sales. But also there was, for us as a very tiny business that has never been particularly well capitalized, there were a lot of improvements that we were doing. I look at it in a very long-term way, you know. So we'd started putting in a new butchery years ago, and we'd built this bit and we'd done that bit, but none of it had been pulled together. And so we actually, when the world went mad and suddenly everyone wanted to buy from Northfield Farm in relative terms, we couldn't cope. Our butchery is so tiny, and it's in the shop essentially. We couldn't have the number of staff in there safely that we needed to produce what was in demand. So, you know, it caused huge pain. We had to put one of our brilliant butchers on furlough because we couldn't fit everyone in the same room safely. Even then, we all had to take risks in terms of proximity because we weren't geared up to it. Mm-hmm. So it was the intensity, I think, of it also for I'm sure for everyone, and I'm sure that's right across, you know, so many fields in business. So it was this almost sense of being frozen in the reality that the world was never going to be quite the same again, and in terms of business, what to do about it. And it's the relentlessness of it day in, day out, worrying about your staff, worrying about your family, worrying about, you know, your flesh and blood who's in the midst of London working 23 hours a day with an incredible team of people around him to feed people. And then of course it was how to fund this, how to protect the people and the business. And so when the loan schemes came out, at first I thought, I've got more than enough debt already. The last thing I want to do is increase debt. Yeah. And I talked to my boys who are directors of the business, and we have a brilliant general manager who's been with us since school. And we sort of act as a management committee as such. And my initial reaction was, I'm not going to load any debt at all. We're going to, you know, sort of hunker down and try and survive it. And then I thought, actually, no, we have to, because who knows if there's another wave, if there's, you know, it's crazy that we were having to limit our orders to 30 orders a day at one stage, because that's all we could do. And that was like Christmas. And so I thought, well, this is maybe an opportunity. It's very high risk. But I went flat out to borrow within the CBIL schemes and the bounce back loan schemes as much as I could, having created a budget for it to invest in the business. So I borrowed over £300,000 to invest in upgrading our processing and make us safer and hopefully as efficient as we possibly can be to look at the long term. So we hang in the balance at the moment because, you know, to do that, and it took a lot of work with the banks. It was very, very difficult to get them to agree to put everything through. A lot of work with the accountant to write cash flows and business plans and everything else. And inevitably, there's a stage with that where the business is losing money because one of the lessons is it's very difficult to spend. Even when the money comes through, it's very difficult to spend it like that and get the results happening.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do. You have to compress the spending period into as small a time as possible to make it happen. Because it's not until the last penny is invested in that plan that the efficiencies will take hold and actually enable you to then expand the business further. I suppose with my old banking hat on, I think the structure of a lot of these loans that have been put through to support businesses are pretty ignorant, frankly. There is an inability of the banking system over here to think long term. These facilities should be available for 10, 20, 30 years. Particularly, I speak for myself, obviously, but particularly for smaller family businesses, that the default rate in farming is probably the lowest default rate among any business sector. And one of the main reasons for that is because we live our businesses. Yeah. We live and breathe our businesses. We live and breathe in our businesses in a way that almost no other sector does. And, you know, I'm open to be corrected if I'm sure there are other examples. But because of that, the real risk, providing, you know, people aren't too massively overstretched and providing there is some viability to the business, because of that, the banking industry should be looking far longer term. Because I'm sure you look very long. I don't know how many generations, but many generations into your farming life.
Yes.
You know, we look... The horizon is way beyond our own lifetimes in traditional farming. Mm-hmm. And that is a massively underappreciated asset by bankers, because bankers are so far removed from the reality of running a business. I mean, some of the questions we had to ask, and we have our main bank is HSBC. They have been incredibly supportive and what have you. But some of the questions that came down from their credit departments were staggering. In terms of their lack of understanding of basic business principles. Mm-hmm. And you know, I hope they don't pull all my my facilities if I get quoted on that. And also, of course, what happened is because of the length of time in getting that money, you can't commit to the expenditure. So it took six or seven weeks to get it, you know, from plan into the bank. So that's 6 or 7 weeks lost between putting those orders in, which then take in some cases like new roller shutters and speed doors and, you know, stuff that we need as part of this plan. So you're suddenly 3 months, 4 months before your decision to spend the money and to borrow it and spend it and actually for it to make a change. Mm. So it's been, from a business perspective, it's been very, very difficult, as I'm sure it is for, you know, hundreds of thousands of businesses.
But at the same time, I guess, and it's an exciting time for you though, because expanding and I know you were telling me earlier you're taking on the neighbouring stall at Borough Market and you're looking to do different products. I mean, it is an exciting time, as well as, I guess, quite daunting.
Very much so. Yeah, we've invested in charcuterie chambers. We've invested in slicing technology. We've invested in infrastructure. I mean, it's all a very big investment in trying to make do better from a, both a business point of view, a quality point of view, and a range. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to do a very big push on local deliveries and on mail order. It's very exciting. Very, very. It's scary at times, but very exciting. Yeah, I think nationally, there's going to be a very when the first anniversary of these loans mm-hmm. Comes up, and when people actually have to start servicing them, I think there is going to be a massive default rate, or, and I think it's being talked about already, the banks are going to have to think very carefully about extension and renegotiation of terms. I mean, we are ahead of our budget as it stands in terms of developing the charcuterie products, in terms of, well, across the board. But that budget is still, you know, it's a scary thing because there's stuff happening all the time that no one can predict. But I think, as I say, the bank came through in a very supportive way, and even pending some, because we have three businesses, so we've got a C-bills and a couple of bounce backs. They even put facilities in while they were struggling to handle the administration of some of the stuff. So, but I know a lot of people have suffered, and some banks have fallen way below what they needed to do.
What about consumer habits? Do you think, I mean, people have tended to change their shopping habits? They've been using perhaps the local butchers, whereas they've been previously, maybe they haven't set foot in there for a long time. Maybe they've just been using supermarkets. We've heard a lot of examples of that over the past few years. And you said that your orders went through the roof when the crisis started. Do you think that will carry on? Or do you think that people will slip back into the...
It's the $60,000 question. I think a certain amount will stick. But I think it's for us as producers and communicators to find ways to support the stickiness, yes, if, for want of a better expression.
Yeah.
I think we have to get better at telling our stories. Mm-hmm. I think when I started the business, I spent a lot more time than I do now telling our story. And I think I need to go back to that if I can. The trouble is we get so sucked into the daily administration of what we do that it's very difficult to do what you and I are doing now, you know. And obviously my relaunch is going to be by virtue of this podcast.
Is that
and
right?
It will, I will owe you steaks forevermore. Well, who knows? But it is, you know, it's the perennial question is how do farmers better communicate? There is clearly, I think, an ongoing gulf of misunderstanding between town and country. Mm-hmm. There is a huge lack of awareness of what it takes to plant a crop,
yeah,
and do something with it. There's a, you know, or to, you know, produce a calf or a lamb or a piglet or whatever it is, let alone then the actual food production side of it. You know, start with the carcass and go it on, take it on. I think we've got a lot to learn, sadly, that we don't appear to have learned from our European counterparties, spending not massive amount, but reasonable amounts of time in Italy and having been at university in France and traveled elsewhere in Europe. There is a deep embedded position in the everyday life for the countryside and farming and for food and the link between all of those things. There's a theory that goes between, it's partly the result of a differential inheritance law. Mm-hmm. So over here, basically, people leave whatever they leave to whoever they want. Under the Napoleonic Code in France, Italy, and Spain, you have to leave.
Yeah.
You have to split the properties. Now that can undermine properties and businesses financially, but culturally it tends to create much less of a distance between town and country. And I think that's quite important. Whatever it is, we need people to understand more about what it takes to produce food. So we for many years were, I think we missed 1 year last year because we just felt we couldn't cope with the number of people, but we've been part of the Open Farm Sunday movement. And the year before last, we had, I think we counted 740 people or something crazy. And we're very small, and to deal with more than that, we just couldn't see how to put the infrastructure in place last year. So we didn't do it, but we were going to do it again this year. And obviously it's been canceled. I think that's an incredibly important innovation, but it needs more. It needs constant drumming in. It needs celebration. You know, we've had all this debate over the Agriculture Act. Our farmers, large and small, need to be celebrated. And I would say, of course, especially the small ones, but they need to be celebrated from top to bottom in this country. They need to be celebrated by their communities and by their governments, regional and national. I think there's also, I'm very interested in the concept of reciprocity and the concept of local economies. So when I see, we've sponsored our local rugby team, for example, our local rugby club, I think for longer than any other sponsor. There are many businesses that are much bigger than us. But when my boys went to play rugby, I recognized a sense of community, but I also recognized that the minis, as they were, the kids that were playing and starting, were being fed shockingly bad quality sausages. Yeah. So I took on gifting, you know, sausage, thousands of sausages every year, which we've done for 20 something years.
Yeah.
Well, that's a community. Now, I don't know whether we get a lot of reciprocity from that community, but I want to push that community to recognize it. And I think, you know, for example, sports clubs, whether in the end one played rugby, one played football, these clubs rely on sponsorship from local communities. So what I think we need to do is encourage reciprocity. So if, I don't know, the Ford dealer is one of our sponsors, Land's End, the American-based or Oakham-based American clothes company, is a big sponsor, far, far beyond us in terms of the value of their sponsorship. If we can get people connecting with each other and swapping services and reciprocating properly, it's a bit like, that's what I used to do in banking. You know, it was all about reciprocity and mutual support and communication. If we can make that happen again, we will strengthen local communities, particularly in rural areas.
And create
a stronger economic base and cultural base in these areas, which I hope will, with support, will strengthen things on a much broader basis.
Fantastic. That's brilliant to hear. We're going to have to wrap it up with a quick quiz because time's flying by. If you're ready for the hard-hitting questions, what's your all-time favourite song?
Oh, dear. As a kid, I used to listen to my father singing Danny Boy, so there's the Irish bit. As an adult, I think Chris Christopherson and Me and Bobby McGee kind of sums it all up.
What a great choice. That is a brilliant choice. I love that. Chris, yeah, because Janis Joplin did a brilliant version as well, but
yeah,
the Christopherson version is the pinnacle.
Janis
you're having a fantasy dinner party, three guests, alive or dead. Who are you having?
Well, obviously, I'd love to see my parents again, but I think the three people I would have, and I won't offend any dead ones. I'd have to invite Clarissa back.
Yep.
She used to say that her last meal would be the last meal where she condemned would involve White Park beef. So that's what would be on the menu. I was not a close friend, but there's a wonderful photographer called David Douglas Duncan who influenced my life a lot. I met him a lot in when I was living in France. He died a couple of years ago at the age of 102.
Wow.
And he was one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. And I recommend anyone that's listening to look him up. He's worshipped as a hero in France, and there's all sorts of tributes to him in the States. Mm. And by a succession of chances, I was given a whole load of his cameras last year. So I'd have to have David Douglas Duncan. And I think looking at living, one of the, I've never met him or spoken to him, but I think I might well, to keep the farming link, I'd probably invite James Rebanks, Herdy Shepherd, from Cumbria, because I think I'd love to meet him and hear. I think he has a fabulous message and a fabulous way of delivering the story of farming in a very real but also a very attractive way.
Yes, I'm supposed to be, when COVID calms down, I'm supposed to be going up there to interview him, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fantastic.
What one tool, gadget, or piece of equipment could you not manage without on the farm?
I think probably my son and his girlfriend.
Very good answer.
he's as strong as a bulldozer, and she's a vet. And,
oh, well, there you go.
And I mean, what else is there?
Exactly.
Who needs tractors?
Yeah. Well, you've achieved an enormous amount in your life. You've been through a lot too and got to the other side of it. But what are you most proud of?
Oh, my children.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a not very original answer, I guess. But yeah, they're what kept me alive when I was under the tractor. They're incredible young people, young adults now. There's no doubt.
Okay. And lastly then, other than James Rebanks, Herdwick Shepherd, what's your favourite agricultural related social media account to follow?
It would have to be him.
Yeah.
Otherwise, gosh. I follow a lot of farming accounts. Joe Stanley is very influential.
Yes, he wouldn't be too far from you, would he?
No. I follow a lot in Ireland as well, and some of them are really wonderful, and there's a lot of very small farming businesses.
Yes.
I mean, obviously yourself, you know, I can't really include you.
No.
I did look at some of the stuff that you did in the States and you linked to in the States. I think that's very interesting. I think there is a lot to be that we can learn from them and mm-hmm. they can learn from us. But I'm sorry, I have to go against you and I say James's account is I don't know how he does it. I think he must have 10 people tweeting on his behalf, and it's probably all a fiction. But it's by far the best thing out there.
Yeah, well, he's one of my favourites too. Jan, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really, really fascinating to hear your story and your insight into current events. And I hope you get back to normal soon and COVID buggers off. And I hope it's all a huge success for you.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. It's been fantastic.
Great to speak to you. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.